So I debated about introductory material for Peter and what do we talk about first. And what I've decided to do is we're going to answer the first four questions first. And then we'll get into the introductory material because those first four questions really lead quite well into it. So, James, can we start with you?
To whom is this epistle addressed? Verses 1 through 2 is addressed to the pilgrims and the dispersion of Pontus and Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Lydia.
As good a guess as I have.
I would have guessed Bithynia. But you just say fast. Number two.
Explain the term pilgrims. Well, the idea is that you're not settled here. This is not really your home.
Number three.
Explain the term delay for the payoff to the event.
Okay, we'll talk more about that. Number four.
According to verse 2, what role did the Father play in our salvation? The Holy Spirit, Jesus Christ. Father, He set up salvation before the world was even created. He had His plan already ready to go. And the Holy Spirit, He played in our salvation.
So when we get to that slide, I'm just going to say what Ken said. So all of this we're going to talk more about as we go into this. Just under the heading of what I think is an interesting observation is when we look at 1 and 2 Peter, which is what we're going to be doing for the rest of this quarter, we see 1 Peter dealing with a topic, theme of how the faithful can deal with persecution. There's going to be a lot of talk about their persecution and actions that they need to be taking, as well as the understanding that they need to have of what God has done for us. When we get to 2 Peter, he's going to be dealing more with how the faithful can deal with false teaching. Can you link those two together? Why would he write about how your faith, how you need to deal with persecution, and then how you need to deal with false teaching? Dave's fixing, he's warming up. In what way? So that, exactly. David Mills is saying what Brian said. So there's pressure being applied to them to submit to false teaching, to go along with the crowd. And their persecution may be coming to them because they are resisting or because they want to teach the truth. So this is why I think Peter writes these two books. Now, there's a lot. This is high level, right? When we drill down into it, we're going to see other nuggets that we're going to get out of this, Dan. If it disagrees with me, it's probably not. So outside would be the persecution, as Brian put it, succumbing to false teaching. Right. I'm glad to know the authors of that went along with us on that. So, there's my answer that I put up there. Peter wrote to the churches of Pontus, and I'm going to do like James and just say these really fast. Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia. I got a map so that everybody can locate these. Whenever you see a map like this, we usually have lines drawn, right? Who do we think of doing primarily the teaching through this region? It's not Peter, is it? So, Paul is who we think of. Can somebody read 2 Timothy 1:15 for me? 2 Timothy 1:15. Giving you the short straw on those names, James. I'm sorry. So, Paul is writing to Timothy, and what does he say is the status of the Christians in Asia? They turned away from him. So why would it be beneficial that Peter write? To endorse, to reinforce, to say, now what Paul taught you wasn't just dreamed up. We got this from the Spirit. We got this from Christ. Somebody look ahead to 2 Peter 3:14 through 15. 2 Peter 3:14 through 15.
Therefore, beloved, diligent to be found by him without spot or blemish and in peace. Count the patience of our Lord as salvation, just as our beloved brother Paul also wrote to you according to the wisdom given him.
You see what Peter did? He even referenced Paul at the end of 2 Peter to endorse him, to say, don't give up on the teaching that Paul provided to you when you learned it from Paul in the first place. He's reinforcing that sound teaching that he already heard. Alright. Then it says, who are the dispersion? This dispersion, often we think about Christians scattering after the day of Pentecost. Why were Christians scattering after the day of Pentecost? From whom? The Jews. It's persecution from the Jews. Now it's later in time. And the persecution is coming from Rome. Now, I'm not discounting the Jews. I'm not saying that they're not still involved. But Rome has reached a point where they got to blame somebody. Things are not going well in Rome. And Rome blames the Jews. Well, the Jews in turn blame the Christians. And the Jews have some influence with Rome. And so now we have Roman persecution. So these are Christians that are being persecuted by not only the Jews, but they're also being persecuted by Rome. And probably more severely by Rome, just from a secular history standpoint. In 1 Peter 5:13, Peter says that he references the church where he is, and he says it's in Babylon. Where is he? Oh, you're on the right track. There are many schools of thought I will not stand here and say, absolutely, this is what it is. There's a school of thought that says he's referencing a place in Egypt. There's a school of thought that says, no, he's talking about historic Babylon. For me, not that it changes anything about the understanding of the book, but it makes sense that he's talking about Rome. Because Rome is who is persecuting. And Babylon is who was persecuting the children of Israel. He also talks about that Mark sends greetings in 5:13. And if you remember, Paul asked that Mark would come to him because he was valuable to him. Right. Right. So I think there's some parallel, but I'm not going to die on that hill. That's just what tends to be the understanding. Y'all have anything else so far?
Wouldn't this have been more understanding that he would be teaching more to the Jewish Christians here because they would have understood that Babylon? Not taking away from anything what we've already said about it, but back in they would have understood these interpretations a little bit better than what the Gentiles.
Potentially.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. It's hard to be definitive and say these are only Jewish Christians because it's such a late date. And Paul taught in these regions, and he didn't just teach to Jews, he taught to the Gentiles too.
But I have the impression that the blame Rome has given on the Jews on the Christians, I think in my own mind, they have been harder on the Jews that have become Christians than they would have been the Gentiles. So the persecution there, even though it's great for both sides, you know, he's really pushing.
Let Brian straighten us all out.
I found it interesting that Gideon has mentioned, and the only reason I found that interesting, you know, Acts 16, Paul is forbidden to go to Bithynia, and you think, well, for Bithynia, I guess they didn't get an opportunity to hear the gospel. Well, they didn't get
somebody preached it.
Yeah, somebody preached it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting point. See, the Bithynians heard the gospel. All right. We can talk more about it, Alan. Alright. The verse says, elect according to the foreknowledge of God, in verse 2. Who doesn't have a King James or a New King James? And tell me what yours says. Okay.
It says, according to those who are elect, according to the foreknowledge of God.
So the word elect is just later in the verse. It doesn't start.
Actually,
because I thought it wasn't in the verse.
Middle of verse 1, and I skipped over exiles and the dispersion.
So the word elect is in verse 1 in the ESV. I didn't catch that. Okay. I only looked at verse 2. In American Standard, most translations, apparently, I'll have to go back and look at this, maybe the word elect is in verse 1, but it's not in verse 2. It's the King James and the New King James that puts the word elect in verse 2. So, what does that mean? To say, God elected us. Did he go, Alan and Ricky, but not David. Who else do I want to pick? It's like on the schoolyard picking teams. I was concerned when you started saying predestined, but you cleared it up when you started talking about we have the choice. I think the best illustration that makes the most clarity for me is thinking about athletic competitions. Because I don't really follow NFL, but isn't there a big game? Is it tonight or next Sunday? Next Sunday? So we now know actually who's going to be in that game, right? Because the process has been completed. But could we have said who was going to be in the game at the beginning of the season? Not by saying, who's in it? Philadelphia and Kansas City. I know more about NCAA. We can't say, at the beginning of the season, we could have said that. But at the beginning of the season, what could we have said? Whoever wins one division versus whoever wins the other division, and whatever that process is that makes that come together, that's who's going to be in that game. Jason. Makes sense, but I want to make sure we're clear that when you say the omnipotence of God, that did he look forward in time and say, now in 1959 there's this little kid going to be born at Jackson Hospital and he's going to be one of mine?
I would say yes.
I would say no.
Really?
Yes. If the little kid wants to, yes. But nor does he put his hand on that little kid and make him his.
Well, I can understand he doesn't. He's not going to. But what I said later was God chose this father body with the gift for us to choose him.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
you can't. What you can't take away is that we are free moral agents. Yeah, but he does not influence what we choose.
Directly, yeah.
Right? What would we be if he did that? Yes, the big word, Mike. I'm looking for something I can understand.
That's what I am.
Well, I don't understand that big word. Jacob? He's laid out a way, and it's up to us to choose that. But if we were forced to follow that path, the word that I'm looking for is we'd be puppets. Right?
Right.
What kind of God would have puppets serving him? You're opening up another can of worms, Bob, but it doesn't serve God any reward for us to be in compelled service. But if we choose to serve Him, and we look at His plan that He's laid out, and we say, that's it. That's what there's wisdom from God, as we talked about in James. And we choose to follow that, then we become the chosen. Because those are the ones who will follow the will of God. Well, I'm saying it makes sense. Right.
I like to think of it in terms of which brings greater glory to God. People who read about the wonderful grace and mercy of God are so impressed right. with that that they choose to yield their life completely to Him. Right. That are those who have no other choice but to do that. You are predetermined. You're going to serve me.
God is honored when that plan is fulfilled. Roger and then Sean. You yield to the gentleman? And it's interesting that you say that verse in Hebrews talks about counting the blood of Christ a common thing, because here in chapter 1, he's going to call the blood of Christ a precious thing. It's an interesting contrast. Roger? Okay, I think we're all on the same page. I'll let Brother Billy have the last word.
Let's not confuse the issue.
I don't think we have.
Well, I'm not confusing the papers. But I think you're on the right track. Because he is not teaching predestination here. We analyze the problem.
I believe that's what's been said. Okay, well, after class, tell me what the this, that, and the other was, because I think we're all on the same page that God didn't say James and Penny, but not Lamar. He didn't pick us out. He gave us a plan. So, in lieu of our time, we'll move on. Salvation is provided because of three things that he lays out. Number one, the plan of God, which is what we've been talking about. Then there's the sanctification of the Spirit for obedience. I would have put it this way. Set apart for obedience by the Spirit. And when we get to the end of the chapter, I think there's even some better phrasing to help with the understanding of what is happening with the sanctification of the Spirit. But that's what sanctification means, right? Is to set something apart, to make it dedicated for a service. There's also the power of the blood of Christ. It's a sacrifice that was made for forgiveness. And coupled with that is the resurrection. As we go through this chapter, he's going to talk a good bit about the resurrection and how that resurrection is so valuable to us in preparing us when persecutions and trials would come our way. So, anything on these 3 points? We're going to hit these 3 points again at the end of the chapter, see? All right. So, let's do 5 through 10. This section talks about a living hope. So, somebody give me a definition of hope. If you've ever been in one of my classes, I've covered it. Say it again, Brother Billy. Say it again. Okay. What's the definition of hope? The key word was realistic and expectation. So here's what you'll always hear me say when we get to hope is, when I was a kid, I hoped to get a Schwinn varsity 10-speed. There was no expectation. That was just a wish. And often in the modern English language, that's the way we use hope. I hope Alabama comes back and wins the national championship next year, just to bring this football analogy full circle. Is there an expectation of that? It's kind of going to depend, isn't it? There's a lot of things happening right now. I can't count on it. If I get pulled over by a state trooper for speeding, what can I expect that I don't hope for? A ticket. So you can expect something and not desire it. You can desire something and not expect it. But when those two thoughts are put together, that's biblical hope. We're talking about a resurrection for us. We desire it and we expect it. Realistic expectation was the way that Russ put it. And we have a living hope due to the resurrection of Christ. Why the living hope? And there's another reason. Christ was resurrected. Christ is alive. So in Him we have a living hope. And we have an inheritance that's incorruptible, undefiled, and lasting. If you think about what we were talking about last quarter, how is this opposite of James? I said last quarter. Last lesson. What was corruptible? What was... What men put their hope in, their wealth. James talked about it was corrupted, moth-eaten, corroded. We are kept by the power of God for salvation. Can somebody get 2 Timothy 1:12? So this is we're getting to it. See, people will come out of that elect statement, and then they'll come into this kept statement, and they'll say, see, him. I can't fall from the grace of God because I'm kept. That's not what it's talking about. So who's got the first, 2 Timothy 1:12? What I've committed, the choice that I've made, how I'm living my life, the choices that I make, if I do that, then He will keep me. That's, I think, the direction that this is going in. And if we have this hope, then there's an opportunity to rejoice when suffering and trials, persecution comes our way. The trials are the testing and the proving of our faith. I think it was Philip and Pete. We were talking about, this is going to be a football Sunday is what it is. I keep coming up with these football analogies. Philip and Pete and I were talking about how this particular team, back when college football was going on, and they just annihilated this other team. And we were talking about, well, why? Well, the winning team, they faced those tough battles every week. They had to play hard teams every week. And it toughened them. And they became strong. The other team, you know, what do they call it, cupcake games? They were playing cupcake games every week. And it didn't harden them. It didn't toughen them. I see the parallel in this. And when we're going to have trials. We're going to have struggles. And those things toughen us. Those things prepare us. You can overcome a small test. And you're stronger because you've overcome a small test. And then a little bit harder test comes along. Well, I managed that. I got past that first one. I can get past this second one. And we build our strength and our endurance because of these trials. The anchor that prepares us for persevering these trials is the hope. The hope that we have in a resurrection that causes us to have a life with God. He says in verse 8, "You believe and yet you have not seen." Does that remind you of any event? I got the verse. Thomas. Yeah, Thomas actually had the opportunity to see and believe. And then when Christ is in front of him, he blesses him. He says, "Blessed are you because you have seen and you believe. But blessed are those who will never see, and yet they believe." And he's writing to people who, some of them may have not ever lived or visited Jerusalem and was there when the activities that happened surrounding the death and resurrection of Christ. What about us? Anybody here see the death and resurrection of Christ? I wasn't born then. I know I got a lot of gray hair, but I wasn't born then. So he's complimenting them and encouraging them because in their roots of Christianity they have believed in something that they haven't seen. And then there's a statement made, and let me find exactly where I need to. Verse 10, "Of this salvation the prophets have inquired and searched carefully." Old Testament prophets looked for the Messiah. Old Testament prophets, they scoured the Scriptures. They're looking for what's the answer. How is this all going to be resolved? And then he goes on in 11 and 12, talking about the Spirit of Christ who was in them, indicating when he testified beforehand the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would follow. To them it was revealed. So the people in the time of Christ, it was revealed to them. They found out how salvation to all would come. The prophets looked for it. Those people knew it. We know it because it's recorded here. And then he goes on to say, here's where I'm locked up. What he's trying to talk about is the value that's in salvation. that people are searching for it. The prophets are looking for it. It's so valuable that even the angels want to look into it. Salvation hadn't been offered to the angels. Salvation has been offered to us. We know where our salvation lies. I want to say it's Hebrews chapter 10. I had to look it up after class. There's a passage there that talks about how Abraham received aid, but the angels did not get aid. And it's talking about the faith that Abraham had. Before we move to the next section, does anybody have anything else? I put it this way, it's the anchor, it's what we lock into that holds our faith. Does that make sense? Alright, so I'm going to skip the questions here in lieu of our time. So he's talking about the value of salvation, that it's something wonderful. So then he says, therefore, verse 13, what are the things that we should be doing because of the value that's found in our salvation? Starts by saying, be awake. And that's not the words that's in the New King James Bible, but that's the way Lamar reads it, is to be prepared for action. The English Standard Version, the New American Standard Version, the Christian Standard Bible uses that kind of language. Is it ironic to you that Peter would be writing, encouraging people to be vigilant, to be awake? Can you read my mind? Who slept in the garden? Do you think, does anybody else have a brain that wakes you up at 2:30 in the morning and goes, hey, I got something we can think about? Do you think Peter ever wakes up in the middle of the night and his brain wants to think about? So he guards them, driving them to be prepared for action. He tells them to be calm in your faith at the latter part of verse 13. Rest your hope. Be calm. Your hope is secure. There's no reason for panic. Suffering's coming your way, but you know where your hope lies. It's in the grace that is brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. He calls for them in verse 14 to be obedient. And calls to mind for me our study in James, that faith without works is dead. He calls for them to be holy. Again, recalls what we just got finished talking about in James, that pure and undefiled religion. Being holy would be a lifestyle that a servant of God would want to have. Y'all got any comments you want to make about this section? I got a little bit more about it, but giving y'all a chance. So, as he goes on, and if you call on the Father, I think what he's trying to recognize is those who call on the Father are those who are obedient to the Father, those who are serving the Father. So he's talking to them as Christians. So he says, if you call upon the Father, I would have said, if you're a Christian. So, do these things. you're not, if you're a Christian, you're not redeemed with the things of this world. What are you redeemed with? Get it out of wickedness. How does Peter put it? What are you redeemed with? The precious blood of Christ. What makes something precious? If you're talking about precious stones, precious minerals, why is it precious? Rare, it's valuable. What makes it valuable is the scarcity, right? I really believe that the power of God is on full display when we talk about the blood of Christ being precious. Is the blood of Christ scarce? Is there any shortage on the blood of Christ? There's not. Every person ever lived has access to the blood of Christ. It's not scarce. And yet it's precious. So it can only be for one reason. Then, it's not because it's scarce. It's because of the power that's in it. It's because of what it's capable of doing. Jeremy? And therein lies the power. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So, we're redeemed with the precious blood of Christ. He goes on in verse 20 to go right back to the three things that he talked about earlier in the chapter. Verse 20. He indeed was foreordained before the foundation of the world. Sean talked about this. There was a plan from God. And this is the execution of that plan. There's in verse 21, who through him believed in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God. There was the death and resurrection of Christ. That's a part of our salvation. And then in verse 22, the verse that I think gives me more understanding is that the sanctification, our purification, is through the Spirit. Since you have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit. Now, he tells us the answer right there. How does the Spirit work in us? I'm going to hold y'all long enough to answer that. He tells us right there in that phrase that I just read. How does the Spirit work in us? Since you have purified your souls, how? Obeying the truth. That's the way the Spirit purifies us. Because the truth is provided to us by the Spirit. Okay, we can talk next week if we need to more about that.